Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, part of the New Books Network. Today, I'm very excited to have Alexander Gendler as our guest. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the Center for Jewish Life Studies. He's also the president of Publishers Row, which is an ebook publishing house that I think many of our listeners will be interested in. He's joining us today from Chicago, in what is actually my first quarantine podcast this year, to discuss his new book, Hurbum, 1914 to 1922, Prelude to the Holocaust. It is the first of a three-part series being published by Varda Books. Alexander, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Robin, thank you for having me on your podcast.
And so now before we get to the book, I know you have a very interesting personal background, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
About myself. Well, I do not know what to begin with. I was born in the Soviet Union. In 1968, I sent a letter to Brezhnev, leader of Communist Party of Soviet Union at the time, protesting Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. I was 14 years of age. The result was a major of KGB from Moscow. I was born in Vinnytsia, so I wrote it from Vinnytsia. But once they found out that I was only 14, the only problem they caused were for my mother, and they opened the record on me. Later on, I became more active and created an organization in my last year of high school. The result was that I was placed in mental institution.
Wow.
Treated to insulin shocks therapy. And then once they understood that they could not do anything with me, they offered me a choice of either 7 years east, or you're a Jew, you can leave. And in 19, but I told them no, but then they told me, you know, that they would allow me to go back, see my mother after a year or two. Once they did it, I accepted that offer and left the Soviet Union in 1974, in August of 1974. But I tried to go back to see my mother. I have not seen her for 13 years. When I was allowed to go back to see my mother in December of 1987, that was the time when Gorbachev was coming to the United States. Mm. I wrote a piece for New York Times, op-ed piece, telling him, you know, your perestroika and glasnost is all fine and good, but I have not seen my mother for 13 years. I guess that article had an impact, and Catherine Leslie Gelb, secretary at that time, he was an editor of op-ed page, called me and said, well, guess what? Embassy just called now, and they said you can apply. They're not stopping you from visiting Soviet Union. So I went back. I saw my mother for New Year, which was a great thing for me and her. My father died in 71. And then So I did a number of things. I spent there almost 4 months. And then a week before my visa expired, they arrested me again. Detained. Brought to internal security station and announced that by the order of Supreme Soviet of the USSR, Article 31.1, I think, I was being deported from the Soviet Union. So it was the second time I was kicked out of the country where I was born. My interest in this topic, you know, was very, very sudden, you know, because I did not know anything about it. And I was not...
Most people don't.
Right. And I was not... Look at this. John Itzi, executive producer of Morning Edition at that time, I think he's still on NPR. He called me the best source on a subject regarding Soviet Union. That is the best anywhere, including CIA and everything else. And this best source on a subject did not know much about many things in the Soviet Union. In 2016, there was a seminar or something, you know, at Ivo Institute in New York. About the forgotten genocide. It was forgotten genocide 1918, 1919 or 1921, something like this. And I flew there. I had time and it was of interest to me because I did not know much about it. And so there was a bunch of people, you know, professors and lecturers, you know, who knew this topic, and they... You know, forgotten genocide, 1918, 1921, or 1919, whatever it is. They were talking about the genocide, the murder, mass murder of Jews following Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So I met some people there, Engel and some other people that made some talks there. And for me, it was... very interesting. So, but I came back and I thought, well, I already know things. That's good. And that same year, I went to the back to Ukraine, to Vinnytsia, to visit the graves of my parents, and spent there a few weeks in Ukraine, and I was nicely. Impressed with what I found. I mean, the country was free. People were free to speak, to talk, to associate, to move around. For me, it was a great gift. You know, I gave my life. So Soviet people, because I considered myself Soviet, being a Jew, I did not consider myself either Ukrainian or Russian. Soviet, you know, it's like American.
Right, rather than an ethnicity.
Right. So I felt myself to be part of Soviet people. And then Soviet people fell apart with the Soviet Union. So, but in any ways, Ukraine is nation state of Ukrainian people. But it had plenty of space for Jews, at least. Did not expect there was going to be a Jewish president of all places in the world in Ukraine. After all, the Jews are gone. But in any case, so I came back to Chicago, and 2 weeks later, I was shocked. In my hometown of Vinnytsia, there was procession of Ukrainians going through the center of the city, to the place where they placed a monument, a bronze monument to Semyon Petlura.
Okay.
Now, Petlura, for those who know, was the first president of independent Ukraine and leader of independent Ukraine, and his troops, Kiev committed incredible atrocities against Jews in that part of the world.
Okay.
On the one hand, Petlura seems like did many things for Jews. You know, he was before 1918, you know, many of his comrades even were accusing him of being philo-Semite. He was for Jews.
And for our listeners, what timeline? What was the period at which he was president for our listeners?
Well, he was president only for 1 year, maybe just very short period of time. You know, when he declared his leadership, it was, I think, in December of 1918.
Okay.
And then he was pushed out from there by Bolsheviks, and he moved to Vinnytsia, of all places.
Yeah.
And established the first, a temporary at least, capital of Ukraine, of independent Ukraine there in downtown Vinnytsia, where there was old hotel, and that's where his government was. And he confiscated the house of Jewish owner of the steel factory and made it his own. White House place residence. Right. I mean, let's not forget that although he was a nationalist, he also was a socialist, you know, because one of the biggest thing for Ukrainians was to get the land from landlords and from Poles who were a lot of them were owners of the land. And at the same time, you know, while they're doing it, to rob the Jews.
Okay. So, and so this procession then was in the early 2000s, this commemorative?
2016.
Got it. Wow.
Yeah, 2016. This is when they established the monument, opened the monument for Petlura.
Wow.
Now, that was a shock to me. And could not reconcile this. On one hand, my impression that Ukraine was free and seemingly progressive, wanting to look forward with this idealization of the figure that in my mind was closely associated with horrific genocide of Jews. Depending on who you listen to, his followers killed anywhere between 50 to 100, 120,000 Jews. That is directly inflicted death. We do not account people that have escaped and died on the road, which probably would increase this figure two or three times.
Sure, yeah.
So in any case, I started looking into it and started reading. And then I see there's a little problem with this YIVO conference title, Forgotten Genocide. It begins in 1918. And I see that my information goes to 1917. And then I see it goes before revolution. I thought that the whole thing was, he started it, like they said in Iwa at that time, as a result of revolution. And what I find the 10th volume of a journal, Еврейская старина, that is on Jewish history, edited by Shimon Dubnov.
Right, of course. He is very well known.
Right, the 10th volume, which he published in 1918, and of course it was the year when whatever he published, maybe there's few copies remained, and there was no way to publicize because situation completely different was by that time. But I looked at it, and I was shocked. The things that I found in that 10th volume were incredible. What I discovered there was that with the beginning of, with declaration of war against Germany, Germany declared war on Russia on August 1st of 1914. And the second part of the day, Tsar Nicholas II responded with declaration of war back on Germany. So with this, what I discovered that with this declaration of war on Germany, Russian state of Nicholas II at the same time declared war on its own Jews.
Wow, associating them, basically labeling them as German enemies, or is that what the logic was?
That is one accusation. But the reason, of course, was not just simply to accuse them of being pro-German, although Jews were
That's
not
on paper.
Pro-German. This is not the situation like, for example, was with Armenians in Turkey. Armenians in Turkey threatened territorial integrity of Ottoman Empire.
Right.
That is not the case with Russian Jews. More than 350,000 Russian Jews were drafted into Russian army. Possibly 500,000.
Wow.
Jews did not have any claims to any territory of Russia to secede. From the beginning, Jews proclaimed their total loyalty to Tsar and Russia across the board. I mean, it's incredible, but many Jews from came back from America, young Jews, to serve in the Russian army. What happened was that Tsar Nicholas II and his army, for them, anti-Semitism was the core of what it meant for them to be Russian soldiers, Russian patriots, Russian army. And on top of it, what I discovered after research, they wanted Poles, Catholic Poles, and Catholic, Greco-Catholic, Greco-Roman Ukrainians in the western part of what is now Ukraine to be loyal to Orthodox Russian Tsar. And to do it, they needed to do something that those two groups wanted. What those two groups wanted, they wanted to rob the local Jews of their property and position within those societies. As a result, declaring war in Germany, Russian Tsarist army automatically gave orders to its own troops to start army-organized pogroms of Jews in order to get rid of them. So the local people, local peasants, would be able to rob and take the property that remained behind them.
Okay.
So the information that was in that Dubnov's 10th volume of Еврейская старина started at the end of December of 1914. And the reason it started that late was because they did not even understand what was going on. They did not have any information. When they started getting information in St. Petersburg, or Petrograd at that time, they changed the name from Petersburg, German, to more Russian-sounding name. Already several months of war were behind them when they started. And this group in new Russian parliament of Fourth Duma. The group of several, there was three Jewish deputies in Duma, and I think there were seven or eight people, maybe a little bit more, in that committee that they called Political Bureau. One of the functions of that political bureau, besides making presentations to different parties in Duma on behalf of Jews, was to collect this information. But it started only in December of 1914. So they did not have much of the information that started previous to it. So this is what I did in my book. I did as much searching as I could.
Right.
And I put that book based on the information that was collected by this Politburo and published by Semyon Dubnov, plus on additional information that was gathered by different researchers already in recent times when Soviet Union fell apart and access to this information became available. American researchers and Ukrainian research and Russian researchers. And then I put it all together. And what I see a horrific crime committed by Russian army, headed by Russian state, not only Russian army. Russian army was headed by the uncle of Nicholas II.
Okay.
And his main guy for the purpose was Nikolai Yanushkevich, a chief of general staff. And that whole army was, whole Russian army showed itself as a result of my, to me, showed itself to be nothing but a bunch of criminals. I mean,
wow.
Two-thirds of the book are the orders issued by different generals and ranking members of that army regarding Jews. And all of those orders are just kill, 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 deprive, 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 deport, 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 deport. More than
I said unequivocal, yeah.
More than 1.1 million Jews have been uprooted from their homes. Massive deportation on May 5th from what is now Lithuania, Latvia, a part of Poland and Belarus. That deportation alone threw out of their homes 200,000 Jews. Now, when we say 200,000 Jews, we're talking about it's largely old men, women and children, because younger men were all drafted in Russian army.
Right, right. That makes sense. I mean, the documents that you include in the book are really striking, and like I said, unequivocal in their purpose. And as a historian myself, I really appreciate you including the documents. It really lets us see, you know, sort of organically what this history was and how it unfolded. And before we get into talking, you know, about what happened specifically, and we will, I wonder if you could tell us your take on why this topic hasn't been written about before, and why it's, I mean, with the exception perhaps of Dubnov, and this conference at YIVO that you mentioned, but that only looked at 2 years of this genocide. Why is it a topic that, you know, hasn't been extensively covered in the historiography?
They looked at 2 years of the genocide after the Russian Revolution. That portion of genocide, the knowledge of it was available to many people. I mean, everybody knew about Petlura and things like this. About and they did not know the details, but they knew at least some major elements of it. Of course, the people that were at that conference were major scholars of that subject, and they made major contribution in that area. But what is more surprising, that none of them mentioned 1914, 1915.
Right. And why do you think that is? Was it an availability of sources thing that then you were able to tackle that others hadn't before? Or was it just that it was overshadowed by, you know, events that came after it?
I'll start with the second one. I spoke recently to one of the leading, maybe major, scholars in Yiddish culture of Eastern European Jewry, and that culture was for that period. And what is, of course, in Yiddish, incredible amount of information was available at that time. Now, in a certain way, because it was never published, I said incredible. Well, I'm going to take it back, because some of the information was available.
Okay.
Because Yiddish writers, for example, one of the major contributors of our knowledge about the topic is Simeon Anski.
Okay.
His book, was actually two of his books, two books on his, based on his diary, on Simeon Anski's diary and what he did during the war, have been published in the United States. Very good books. One is by, she translated his diaries, Polly Zavadivker. She is, I think, she used to be at Indiana. I think she's now somewhere out east. In any case, so information, let me start a little bit differently, answer this question.
Sure.
In English press of that time, there was maybe one or two articles in England, I think in Times of London, and maybe one or two articles in New York. Although Yiddish press was full of different kinds of protests and heart-wrenching, you know, letters from people, and people knew about something horrible taking place in this 1914-1915.
I see.
No concrete information was available at that time. That is, people were getting some letters or some information, maybe from neighbors or somebody who already was deported by, and they, of course, could not write, you know, because the Russia censored absolutely everything.
Right, and they're in extreme distress.
You know, so it was not... they knew that there was something horrible taking place, but they did not know what it was. Now, on the other hand, the American ambassador, it was an interesting group headed by Samuel Harper, a son of the founder of the first president of University of Chicago.
Yeah.
He is the... founder of Russian studies in the United States. So him, his major sponsor, businessman by the name, last name Crane, who was a very good friend of Woodrow Wilson.
Okay.
And State Department with the ambassador in Russia. They did absolutely everything in their power to make sure that no information whatsoever will get to English press in the United States on the subject.
Is that because of an alliance with Russia at the time? Or?
Well, the United States was not active
Britain was, though, right?
Britain was, Britain and France. The United States was, of course, on the sides of Britain, and Britain did not want any problems, you know, about Russian massacres bothering their alliance with Russia.
That's very interesting.
But besides it, Samuel Harper, who, like his father, visited Russia at the end of 19th century, he took position of, during pogroms in Russia at the end of 19th century, he took pro-Tsarist position. You know, like many people, like in 1930s, you know, some correspondents from New York Times took pro-Stalin position.
Right.
The same way president of University of Chicago and his son took pro-Tsarist position. And they continued that position during the war. So not only little information was coming, but whatever information coming, they made sure it would not get into English press.
I see. Interesting.
So in France, police actually actively would come to anybody who attempted to publish anything in French press and threaten them with deportation back to Russia. So, and then when the United States entered the war in 1917, of course, the United States itself became very interested in not having any of this information being made available, because what, we're allies with the monster? No, we're allies with the Great Russia, whatever it is.
Right.
And whatever information that was coming in German was, of course, automatically dismissed because, hey, this is the information from enemy.
Right. So it's a propaganda history.
Now, what is interesting, you know, like, for example, Armenian genocide. I mean, although not everybody recognizes officially Armenian genocide, which is, I believe, is a problem, but everybody knows about Armenian genocide. Armenian genocide figured very prominently in 1918 Paris so-called peace conference, where you know, Germany was found guilty. That was one of the main things, you know, that allies were accusing Germany and its ally Ottoman Empire of being perpetrators of. Neither Germany nor Russia was invited to that peace conference. And allies did not have any intention of talking about it.
Very interesting.
What is interesting about this memory of these events, talking to, I'm not going to name his name, you know, it's not that important, but he's a very, very famous scholar and a person who knows about it. He wrote about apocalypse in Jewish memory and things like this, so he should have known. So it was one of the two questions that I asked him in private conversation was, how come does he think that this was forgotten? And his answer was, well, it's because Holocaust covered it.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the general narrative, I think, that is in Jewish historiography about why past violence isn't researched as much. So I suppose I'm not surprised that that was the answer that you were given.
Well, if it would be a general person or person who is not an expert in memory, in Jewish memory, I would have accepted it. But it was not a general person. It was the expert in Jewish memory.
Well, this sort of is a good segue into another one of my questions, which is, you know, that your subheading for the book is Prelude to the Holocaust. And so would you argue that this was one event sort of you know, in a narrative arc that leads to the Holocaust then? Like, did it contribute to the escalation of violence, to the ability of people in, you know, the Pale of Settlement to carry out extensive and terrible genocide decades later? So in that sense, are you somewhat agreeing with him that maybe the Holocaust did not cover it up, but overshadow the memory?
Okay, Robin, I'm going to get to your question, but before I'm going to get to it, I'm going to just comment on this comment that you generally agree with him. Because what I told him was this.
Oh, I'm not saying I generally agree with him. I'm saying I'm not surprised he said that. But
okay.
My opinion's out.
Right. Because I thought so too initially. It was one of the thoughts that comes to mind, you know, because, you know, a big event overshadows little event, because you're talking about, you know, 6 million dead and horrific 2/3 of European Jewry murdered.
Right.
What that has to do with this. And then you find things like on the fourth page of my book, I prominently, for this reason, display the citation of the chief rabbi of Vienna, who died in 1927.
Mm-hmm. And I have it open.
Huh?
I have it open.
Right. And it was from preface to 1926 edition of Abel Pond's book, from which I took the images that Abel Pond created. So in our translation, it was in German, but in our translation in English, it sounds like this. Humanity has a short memory. Who today, that is in 1926, still speaks of the atrocities committed by the Russian Tsar? So the rabbi knows about these atrocities.
Right.
But already in 1926, nobody speaks about them.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Now, and the question is of connection between the atrocities and genocide of Russian Jews in 1914-1922 period, and specifically in 1914-1915, to Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Second World War was continuation of the First World War. It was continuation of the process that depending on how you want to look at it, you know, some people look at Second World War just simply as a byproduct of Hitler's charisma and German participation, and you know, people find different reasons for whatever they want to believe, but my view of this, why I connected it, is because the 19th century and 20th century is the time of establishing, of collapse of empires, European empires, and establishing of the nation states.
Right.
Now, before, Jews were subjected often to different types of horrible things. I mean, 17th century, the Crusades, and on and on and on. But within the context of the societies that where it took place, or which came as a result of these events, there was still a place where Jews found to be needed by at least some important actors within those societies. For example, landowners.
Right.
When you have creation, a process of creation of nation states, the leading actors in this process want Jews only to help them to create their nation state. Hmm. Once their nation state is created, they don't need Jews anymore.
I see.
In Poland, especially, it was very, very pronounced because the Jews constituted about 10% of Polish population. And in the cities, probably 40 to 60% or more.
Hmm.
And in manufacturing and industry, the Poles who wanted to create a Polish nation saw it as, first of all, Catholic. Secondly, it was ethnically Polish, and the Poles should dominate industry, commerce, education, whatever else you want to put. They had no need for Jews. It was not only in Poland. It was in many other countries.
I study Turkey and was there as well.
So that is the process. That is, 20th century was the time when this feeling that we no longer need any Jews here, going all the way to the feeling we'd be better off if all Jews would be dead, was not only the number one feeling among Polish nationalists, fascists, especially of People's Democratic Party of Dumsky, who were very pro-Russian because they thought that Russia was going to help them get their western part of Poland from Germany. And so combination, and Russia in its own way wanted these nationalist Poles loyalty. They could not get that loyalty on basis of religion, because Poles are Catholics, Russians Orthodox. So they could get that loyalty only on a basis of common hostility towards somebody else. Poles were hostile to Germans, but not all Poles were hostile to all Germans. For example, Pilsudski army, you know, that was being raised was in German-dominated Austro-Hungarian Empire. That's who was their protector, enemy of Russia. And it's these different actors within First World War that determined from their own personal interests why they wanted to kill Jews. And all of them wanted to kill Jews. All.
Wow.
Poles, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Latvians, Russians. And once again, not all Lithuanians all the time. And not even all Poles at the time. For example, Pilsudski that I mentioned, you know, he needed Jews in order to create independent Poland. And so did Latvians in Latvia, you know, and Lithuanians, and so Petlura in 1918 Ukraine. But it's only for this period of trying to create, to build what they need. They need assistance of Jews. Once they get to power, they no longer need any Jews. They want to kill them all because they want to free the space for their own followers. So
I see. So please go ahead.
So it is in that way that I see the Churban And this is how it was called Khurbam at that time by Yiddish speakers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they thought it was considered the third Khurbam. That is after the first and second temple destruction. And Dubnov considered it the most horrible destruction of Jews in all two millennia of them being in exile.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, he lived till the Second World War and he was murdered.
Right.
At that time. But in 1918, he considered it to be the worst that there could possibly be. In any case, but for me, the issue of memory that you touched on is very interesting. I mean, today, if you ask anybody, I'm talking about people that know these things, you know, what is the first genocide in Europe? Probably they will answer Armenian genocide. Armenian genocide, if I remember correctly, Armenians start on April 24th or 26th of 1915. That is 8 months after the mass murders of Jews by Russian forces.
Wow. So this was, in your argument, the first European genocide?
Chronologically, of course, it was the first.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the number of dead, there could be arguments because, you know, Armenian genocide, there lived, I think, I'm not a specialist in that area. I think there lived about 1.2 million or 1.5 million Armenians. And the number I accept of dead probably 600 or 700,000. This number is now raised to 1.5 million because they take into consideration all those that were able to escape to Armenia, to other places. I do not know. I'm not a specialist, but whatever mm-hmm. it is. In here, we're talking about during the army pogroms, starting with the First World War and continuing all the way through 1915, 1916, we're talking about immediately tens of thousands of murdered people.
Wow.
The deportations, for example, a massive deportation from what is now Lithuania, Latvia, and Belarus of May 5th deportation. So the orders came out in April, and on May 5th, 200,000 Jews have been deported, some by in cattle cars, most of them on foot. Altogether, 1.1 million Jews have been uprooted. And judging on basis from the number of dead normally during such deportations, during the wartime deportations, we're talking about minimum 300,000 dead. Minimum.
Wow, those are remarkable numbers, really. Really remarkable numbers for a history that is very unknown.
Well, I'm going by the same approach that is taken to Armenian pogrom. That is, the 700,000 dead in Armenian pogroms was not the people that were dead, but people that who died during these deportations and during these transfers and during these massacres that took place there.
So how, I mean, I'm always so interested in how researchers go about finding the information that they that they ultimately find. How did you go about uncovering, you know, documentation for this? How did you, you know, beyond, you mentioned these, the sort of letters that were sent in, you know, at the time, contemporaneously. And of course, there's Dubnov's book, but you do so much more than that. How did you go about finding all of this documentation?
Once you get the idea of what you are looking for, and once you understand what you see, to find information is not that difficult. I did not have to go to any special archives or some secret bunkers or whatever it is. The information is available, you know, that I collected and put together. Basically, information available online and in scholarly journals here and there.
Oh, it's just putting the pieces together.
Putting the pieces together. I mean, when I asked historian of Yiddish culture about why he never uses the word genocide. I mean, he writes about this. He writes, he cites, he gives the information about the horrific events that took place, but he never puts it all in one. That is, he does not I do not know. Maybe it's just a process or approach that you take when you come to a particular subject. Or I have to say that to determine that it was a planned genocide, I of course needed to become familiar with the army orders that were issued.
Right. Right.
And that was what helped me, because the orders have been put together and have been published in 1926 in Berlin. And they were collected by the Joseph Gessen. Now, I've taken all information that were provided in his book, plus I got information from other scholars, wherever I could find, as I said, you know, American, Russian, Ukrainian scholars. Ukrainian scholars were helpful in helping to bring the orders and the activity of Russian army all the way to the first week of the war, because that information was not available to that Politburo group that I mentioned before. They started only in December. And but it was in archives. It was in Ukrainian and Kyiv archives of local, at that time, Russian police in Ukraine. A bunch of other places, you know, like anybody else, you know, I just tried to find it. I'm sure that there's many more documents available. But document, I think, for me, was very interesting, was response to a request regarding dismissal of all Jews from engineering building teams of Russian army in 1916, and non-admission of them to any future work in those teams. It was response by Alexeyev, who became the chief of staff instead of Yanushkevich, because the commander-in-chief at this time was Nicholas II himself. So what this Alexeyev writes, basically he says, we do not want any work done if you cannot do it without Jews. And then what he says, but more important, more important to me, that is, we're talking about Jews in the Russian army.
Right.
But what more important in this little insignificant letter that I'm talking about is that he says, following the demand of the higher ups in the military, I request the issuance of order concerning immediate dismissal of all Jews without exception. Now, what is interesting, we're dealing here with the chief of staff of the Russian army. The only person who is higher than him is commander-in-chief of the army.
Which is Nicholas II.
Which is Nicholas II.
Wow.
So this document, there's indirect testimonies to, of course, Nicholas being the chief murderer of Jews.
Wow.
But this document points finger directly at him.
Yep.
He is now a saint of Russian church.
Yeah, that's... There are, I mean, there are so many fascinating documents that you publish in this book. It really is. You know, it's not only a piece of historical research, but it's also in and of itself like a source resource. It's really, yeah.
Robin, I tried to stay away from generalizations and drawing conclusions as much as possible. I tried to make the book as the source for people who are interested in the topic in order for those people that were murdered not to be forgotten.
Yeah, and I think it does that. I think it does exactly that. And I mean, I regret that we're running out of time because there's so much more that I'd like to discuss, but I really do encourage our reader or our listeners to go out and, you know, find or purchase a copy of this book, because not only is Alexander's, you know, the first half of it is Alexander's interpretation of the history, but the second half is entirely documents. And there's also a lot of really amazing artwork in here by, is it Abelpan?
Yes.
Abelpan, who you mentioned in the quote from the chief rabbi of Vienna. There's really so much in here. And but before I let you go, I do want to talk about sort of what this entire project looks like, because I know, you know, you're editor-in-chief of the Forgotten Genocide Project. This is just the first of three volumes that are going to come out on this forgotten genocide. Could you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what the next two volumes will cover and about the project in general?
Well, the other volumes are not going to be as earth-shaking in my mind as this one.
Okay. We'd still love to have you back on to discuss them, but
thank you very much. Regardless. I look forward to it. But they will bring information in English. They'll make available documents and information to English speakers about the events of second portion of this period, that is specifically 1917, 1918, 1919, 1921, 1922, where different actors decided that they want to kill Jews in large numbers. I mean, not only Petlura and his Ukrainian troops, but also Russian troops that were financed, that is, white Russian troops that were financed by England and the United States. And that is, I do not want English men or Americans to simply ignore something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do not want to stick it in anybody's face, because people that did it long ago are gone. But things are taking, you know, when I started this project several years ago, on a website for this project, I wrote that the reason, one of the reasons that I do this project is in order for things like this not to happen in America. So sometime in the future, some people would not look at things that happened to American Jews at what happened to Russian, like what we're, the way we look at what happened to Russian Jews now. At that time, I did not know, could not foresee that it was just within very short period, within short distance, where from massacre at Pittsburgh and at California and in New Jersey and on and on. Nothing like this ever happened before in the United States. Not to Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening now. The United States is not that different from Russia. Yeah, the United States is a democracy, but it's multicultural, multinational, multi-religious society.
Hmm.
Any society that has part of its name, union, united, federated, shows its own Achilles heel. Because by affirming, by insisting that it is united, it shows that it can be disunited.
Mm.
The United States is not an exception.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that, you know, what you've written about and researched helps to prevent any sort of historical repetition.
And when we talk about it, like when I look at Russia today, now, Putin can be looked at as good or bad, whatever. You know, I personally believe that I do not see what, you know, when I was, when I raised demand on the Soviet Union in 1970, that is when I was in school, and my demand was abolition of one-party dictatorship and institution of Soviets, that is, a representative government in the Soviet Union. I was 16 at that time. And I, as a Jew and as an individual, do not see myself comfortably living in any dictatorship. I thought at that time that Russia had the potential of being free. Now, what is interesting, in Ukraine, I did find that feeling of freedom today. But Ukraine is different in its makeup than Russia. The same, what I would say, you know, Amalek complex that created Khmelnytsky's butchery of Jews in 1648.
Mm-hmm.
That same Amalek concept was indication at that time and this time of freedom, natural inclination toward freedom that is integral part of the Ukrainian nation. Why? In what way? unlike in Poland, which is largely, almost totally Catholic, Ukraine is divided by languages, by history, by religious affiliation. So this multiplicity of different identities allows or forces Ukraine toward freedom. Russia, at least for now, who knows what is going to happen in the future, Russia is different in that respect. Russia was empire, multicultural, but the insistence on a single religion, Russian Orthodoxy, plays a very important role in psychology of that nation. And when you have country not of rights, not of law, but country of ideals, that is a very, very dangerous thing. It could be a very good thing sometimes for a short period of time, but on the whole, for me as a Jew, is a dangerous thing. For me, country of rights, that is like the United States, is the best thing. Well, at least for the last 50 years. I do not know, because when you look back to the United States, there's some parts of this country's history that are not very welcoming to Jews. But in the last 50 years, when the United States, after 1960s, changes that it took place in the United States, plus the United States confronted Soviet Union, where it needed a club of Jewish immigration to fight Soviet Union, whatever interest. I prefer, of course, the multicultural societies. Jews always, throughout our history, preferred multicultural society. But this precisely multicultural nature of society is also a source of great danger to our people. And this is what happened 100 years ago, and this can happen again anywhere. That's why I said that the United States is no different in that respect than Russia.
Well, Alexander, I look forward to continuing our discussion, hopefully in the next year or two.
Right.
And I really thank you for joining us today. This has been really fascinating and enlightening. And once again, Alexander's book is called Hurbum, 1914 to 1922. Thank you so much for joining us.
Robin, thank you for having me. And have a great day. Stay away from this thing that is going
you
around.
You too. Stay healthy. What a time we live in right now. I know.
In any case.
Look, enjoy your, I hope you get out of the basement recording studio at least.
Thank you very much for having me. And I look forward to doing more of it. Have a great day.
Absolutely. Thank you, Alexander.
Bye.